About the cutoff, you know, that's a theoretical argument. That's a pure theoretical argument, 30 kilometers per second of what? The cutoff on that scale. But we do know that cannot be right, because we have a galaxies which are lower than that. And, you know, around our galaxy at present, there is something like 40, most of them 10 kilometers per second.
10 kilometers.
Yeah. So will that make difference if you take them?
I think it'll make things worse if I turn it down.
So no, that's fine. I mean, but you need to include them, right?
I just was using, I don't know where David Weinberg is, but I was using his calculation that he and Anatol did, where they included that.
But we know that those guys exist, so it cannot be 100% right.
You can get mixed high ion, low ion, spatially coincident, but with different velocities from something like a cooling flow and a radiative shock, as you might get in an infall or a fountain. What can you say that would distinguish this picture from that?
I'd have to think about that. I think one of the important differences might be this, that the, this sort of indicates to me that we're looking at gravitational motions. The fact that when I plot the carbon-4 velocity width versus the low ion velocity width, there's only, even though they're not correlated, there's a floor to it. I mean, the general, the high ion velocity width, except for these two cases, are not lower than the low ion velocity width. And that indicates to me that really we're looking at motions in the same potential well. And I don't really know, I to be honest with you, I haven't really tested what they're saying. But at least for that sort of comes out naturally in these models where you have different types of flow velocities in the same potential well. But I don't know the answer to your question because I haven't tested that.
Thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to mention that in our CDM model, Matthias' simulations, the carbon-4 arises in the outskirts of these protogalactic clumps and in the filaments. And if you, what you do is you sit on a damp line of the system already, which has to be in a filament by definition almost. So the carbon-4 could be kinematically relatively unrelated to the underlying damp line of the system, but still centered around the damp line of the system. I just wonder how relevant actually the carbon-4 velocity dispersion is for the underlying potential well.
Okay, so what do you, so you're saying you won't get the lineup of the components?
Yeah, I don't see the evidence that this is one potential well.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You think you could reproduce that in your
model?
I don't know, but I'm
not convinced.
I'm not saying nothing else works. I'm saying this. I know this works naturally. Okay. I'm not saying I can rule out other models. Okay. But one thing I didn't get time to say is that none of the models can reproduce the cross-correlation function. That's the most difficult thing to reproduce, because in most of these models, there's just not enough overlap in velocity space between the low ions and the high ions.
That,
I'm sorry? Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I think it's important for you guys to test this and see how it works out.
At this stage, we should, as Tolia decide that we should have the rumble. So, say, Jerry should come up and Lance should come up and either observer or parents can be attacked.
This is for Jerry. Although your box, your final high-resolution box might not have been big enough to answer this question, How do your models get the metallicity in the intra-cluster medium up to a third solar, or do they not?
They do.
And could you show on that picture that you spent so many hours drawing where the...
That picture doesn't show, but we've looked at exactly that question, and in fact, that's a normalization. When you say, how do we get the yield, the one per hour, it's that the cluster gas has a solar metallicity. So I can't use that as a test of the model that's done by construction. It happens to be a reasonable yield, 0.02.
So we can't infer from the cluster metallicity anything such as if we took the average over the intergalactic medium, we'd have the same enrichment. There's something special about the cluster.
Oh, no. No, no. You can tell the ratio. That is high. The average of the Lyman alpha clouds are about a tenth, and the average of the volume average is much lower than a tenth. The clusters are high.
So what makes them higher? I guess that's what I wanted. What makes them higher than the mean intergalactic medium?
It's the same as in the galaxy. The density of galaxies is highest there. The largest fraction of the baryons have been turned into stars in the clusters. And it's the largest metallicity production. It's just another form of the Schmidt model.
But without feedback,
the metallicity is roughly proportional to the density.
And all those metals were formed by the little things that you don't see anymore in the cluster?
No, in the clusters, a lot of them are formed by the mass of galaxies and just get blown out.
But you said feedback wasn't the answer for where the metals were. So it's not true for the clusters. In the cluster case...
It has to get it out. I said, in general, velocities are not more than 1,000 kilometers per second. In clusters, they are 1,000 kilometers per second. In the general field, it's more like a few hundred kilometers per second. So that does put it up a bound, and therefore it's spread around the megaparsec. But this is old news. You just know that from the observation. And many people have shown that if you just take the evolution of the mass of stars that corresponds to the low-mass stars seen in the elliptical galaxy, and say what metals they would have produced, it's the metals you see in the cluster. So there's nothing new in the simulation.
But on that same point, the fraction of the baryons in clusters in the form of stars is not very different from the fraction of the nuclear synthesis baryons in the form of stars in the universe as a whole, so you'd therefore expect the overall metallicity of the intracluster medium in clusters to be rather similar to that of the intergalactic medium.
Right. It's not orders of magnitude. The fraction that has turned into stars in the clusters is a bit high. It's higher than the average globally. And the metallicity is a bit higher, 0.3 compared to 0.1 globally. But also more of it got out. That's clear. And that's because it's gone through a hot wind.
Simple question, Jerry. And a lot of the ionizing photons are provided by star formation in galaxies. But in nearby galaxies, of course, the number of ionizing photons which escape from high-mass star formation regions is quite variable. And, you know, there's dust absorption, ionization-bounded H2 regions. How is that modeled in these models? I don't understand.
We just take a flying stab.
What is that?
What
is the saw or the hatchet?
If you were to take all the O stars above the plane of the galaxy, which is a significant fraction of them, most of those ionizing photons get out. There are some galaxies which are seen in the UV where you can actually measure it, and I think we take a number something like a tenth. A tenth of the ionizing photons get out.
A tenth actually get out. I mean, certainly in some of the starburst galaxies, like the ones I described, that number is much less. But
can I just follow on to that? The recipe gives really impressive results. What happens when you do single parameter shifts? Have you done that in enough detail to show what changes are really, really important for your prescription?
Yes. You can't do that and do high resolution.
No, of course not. So you have to do it on...
Because, you know, this is 3 months on a major computer. But you can compare them all at much lower resolution and change the parameters. The yield is the most obvious one.
on that. And in a previous run, we had 0.06, and we got too much metals in the clusters, and too much star formation, and too much everything else. So we scaled it down to 0.02. But I would guess that's the baryon fraction is a significant variable. If we took that to be 0.05, the mass in galaxies goes to the baryon fraction squared. Okay? Because it's cooling arguments again. The fraction that turns into stars is proportional to the baryon density. And so therefore the amount goes as the square of the baryon density. And so we've lowered that. But at the same time, type or another have been lowering the observed one, so we've done it simultaneously. And I think the current number we have is about 0.035. So it's quite sensitive for that. I don't think it's extremely sensitive to any of the other parameters that go in. You know, obviously you couldn't take far-fetched models like mixed dark matter or something which doesn't have the right power spectrum. But I'm assuming we pretty much know the shape of the power spectrum. Well, if you go through the cluster point and you go through COBE, there's not a lot of freedom in the power spectrum. And we always take those two as given.
We heard yesterday, changing the subject, we heard yesterday about this problem of trying to match the total number of stars at redshift 0 and the star forming rate that people observe at redshift 3 from the Lyman Break galaxy, or you know, derived from SCUBA, and I was intrigued by the fact that you actually were successful in reproducing, you know, the Madhav plots. I was intrigued as to what your conclusions would be regarding the debate. I mean, would you match both the total number of stars at redshift 0 and the number abundance of Lyman Break galaxies?
We haven't checked directly the number of Lyman Break galaxies, so I don't know. But we get the total star formation rate, right? And the sharp cutoff is, as I say, that at late times, the highest density regions are also the highest temperature regions. So, and we wrote a couple of papers on bias relative to that. The idea that galaxy formation is a function of density, or, you know, initially linear, but later on more complicated, seems to me crazy. In the interstellar medium, it isn't that way. It's a function of density and temperature. High density regions, which are also high temperature, don't make galaxies, don't make stars, and we know in the hot gas in front of the galaxy, there's not much star formation. So clearly, if you just look at the sky, you'd say that galaxy formation is a function of temperature and density, not just a function of temperature. And that's what kills it at low redshift, that the highest density regions happen to be the highest temperature regions, and then galaxy formation just shuts off.
At the same time, we heard from David Weinberg that, you know, if you increase the resolution of the simulations, the star formation rates don't seem to converge. So I'm wondering, you know, what's the difference here? If you were to redo the simulations for much higher resolution, would these things converge still? I mean, would the total number of fractional mass, that is...
It doesn't seem to. So at least within the domain that we've computed.
So there's an experiment that can do numerical simulations.
But it may be that they haven't taken a large enough thought.
There's actually two of the things that you said, because we told us, first of all, for the metallicity, is that the star fraction, and therefore the metallicity, was highest in the clusters. And now you just told us that the galaxy formation is suppressed, but the temperature is highest.
Apparently,
actually, the galaxy was most efficient when the temperature is highest.
Both are true. What happens is, those are the highest density regions of Burley, and they have by far the highest star formation. And then, as it collapses you get a shock going out, and it just shuts off. At the end of the day, it's still a little high. As I said, it's not very high compared to the average. And they're not very biased traces. But star formation rate, they're very anti-biased by the end of the simulation, just because they're in very hot regions. Integrated over time, they spent a lot of their time before Ben Moore showed them. I'm sure that's correct. It's on a basically rhythm. We have the same thing happening at much worse resolution, but it's the same phenomenon.
They're simply cooling. They're not big,
galaxies, before the cooling of the gas, we can get into what? Now, I say two things together. It can't accrete. The cooling times are very long compared to most of the gases in the coma cluster. The cooling times are very long compared to the normal cluster. Some clusters in the central regions are supposed to have cooling flow, but in general, the gas is much too hot to cool, and it couldn't accrete. Whereas in the groups, you see lots of star formation, and there's some gas accreting off the galaxy.
So a follow-on to Julio's comment, I think we have little idea about the global star formation rate observed, either observationally or predicted from the simulations at high redshift, because observationally we go only so far down the luminosity function, and then either you cut it off there or you extrapolate. There's some chunk of that that's integrating over an unseen portion of the luminosity function, or else you cut off at some place, right? So you're saying you can't add that much to it. But in any case, you go down to some particular level. The same is true in the simulations. The reason it's hard to predict the global thing robustly is because we resolve galaxies down to some certain level and then stop. So the meaningful comparison is to say, if you take the galaxies above some given space density, what is their contribution? And I mean, that's a comparison one can do fairly robustly, or by comparing the luminosity functions or comparing the integral of the luminosity functions above some level. But the comparison between the total star formation rate from the simulations and the total star formation rate inferred from the observations, I think, is much less robust.